Picture a secret gathering on a remote island in 1910, where America's most powerful bankers traveled in disguise, using only first names to conceal their identities. This wasn't a conspiracy to rob the nation, it was an attempt to save it. For decades, America had suffered through devastating financial panics with alarming regularity, yet the country remained paralyzed by a deep-seated fear, creating a central bank. The ghost of Andrew Jackson, who had killed the Second Bank of the United States 70 years earlier, still haunted the halls of Congress. But by the early 20th century, this ideological purity came at a staggering cost. America had become an economic giant hobbling on a primitive financial system, lurching from crisis to crisis with no safety net. The question wasn't whether reform would come, but whether it would arrive before the next catastrophe struck. Why did Americans resist what every other major economy had embraced? The answer lies deep in the national character. Tocqueville marveled in the 1830s at how Americans feared centralized power above almost everything else. This was an abstract philosophy. Farmers in Kansas and Iowa watched distant New York bankers control credit flows like a faucet. Between 1873 and 1897, wheat prices collapsed from $2.84 to 90 cents per bushel, devastating rural America while enriching creditors. The monetary system was chaotic. Seven different currencies circulated simultaneously. Six entire states combined had fewer banknotes than tiny Connecticut. When harvest season arrived and farmers desperately needed cash to move crops, money simply wasn't available. Without a central bank to inject liquidity during panics, the system would periodically seize up. In 1907, Wall Street nearly collapsed until J.P. Morgan personally orchestrated a rescue, locking fellow bankers in his library until they pledged enough money to stabilize markets. This private bailout was effective, but terrifying. America's financial stability depended on aging tycoons rather than stable institutions. Paul Warburg, a German banker arriving in New York in 1902, found America's financial system shockingly primitive. Despite being the world's largest economy, it lacked central reserves, liquid commercial bill markets, and flexible currency. When Warburg advocated European-style reforms, American bankers dismissed him as un-American. But Senator Nelson Aldrich listened. His 1908 delegation studied European central banks, where officials were politely condescending. The Bank of France governor dismissed Americans' obsession with reserve quantities over quality. After 58 meetings, Aldrich told Warburg, "You say we cannot have a central bank, and I say we can." Yet both knew American anti-centralization instincts demanded a uniquely American solution. The challenge was creating something delivering central banking's benefits while respecting federal structure and democratic traditions. A bank that didn't look like a bank, centralization that didn't feel centralized. In November 1910, Aldrich's group, including Warburg, representatives from J.P. Morgan, a National City Bank, and a Treasury official, spent 8 days at Jekyll Island crafting a revolutionary plan. Their solution featured 15 district branches topped by a National Reserve Association in Washington, with each bank having one vote regardless of size. The system would create elastic currency backed by commercial paper and gold, expanding and contracting with business activity rather than being tied to government bonds. The 1912 presidential campaign transformed the debate. Woodrow Wilson's Democratic victory, along with Democratic control of both houses for the first time in 20 years, changed everything. Wilson, the first president with a PhD, brought scholarly precision to politics. Though publicly offering only platitudes about banking reform, he privately told supporters the Aldrich plan was 60-70% correct. His challenge was transforming banker-designed legislation into something progressive Democrats could support. That task fell to Carter Glass, a hot-tempered Virginia congressman who had educated himself thoroughly on banking, and his aide, Parker Willis. In December 1912, Glass presented his plan to Wilson, 15 to 20 privately owned reserve banks issuing currency and holding deposits. Wilson demanded a capstone, a central board in Washington above the reserve banks, mirroring federal structure. Glass resisted, but Wilson's instinct was brilliant. A presidentially appointed Federal Reserve Board would satisfy progressive demands for government control while giving Wall Street the coordination it craved. When Bryan threatened resignation unless the bill included government-issued currency and excluded bankers, Wilson consulted Louis Brandeis and chose sides. On June 17, 1913, he told Glass, "I will eliminate all banking representation from the Federal Reserve Board." Wilson then executed a remarkable sleight of hand. He convinced Glass to accept Bryan's demand that Federal Reserve notes be obligations of the United States, explaining this gave the other fellow the shadow while preserving the substance of the thing. Glass felt he'd won on substance, Bryan on principle, and Wilson had his compromise, a step toward eventual fiat currency. When the revised bill was published, conservative publishers recoiled. The New York Sun called it covered all over with the slime of Bryanism. Wall Street bankers who had urged reform now balked at federal control, particularly objecting to the central board's power over discount rates. Wilson broke tradition by personally addressing Congress in June, appearing in formal dress despite Washington's brutal summer heat. He framed banking reform as companion legislation to tariff reductions, insisting banks should be instruments and not the masters of business. Rural Democrats attacked from the opposite direction, demanding more direct lending to farmers and agricultural representation on the board. To overcome this agrarian revolt, Wilson worked personally with wavering committee members. When Glass read Bryan's letter supporting all the details, Democrats cheered, while opposition leader Robert Henry turned white with anger. The House passed Glass-Owen overwhelmingly, 285-85. The Senate proved more difficult, with three Democratic holdouts threatening to join Republicans. Frank Vanderlip proposed a radical alternative, a wholly government-controlled central bank with publicly held stock. Wilson firmly rejected this, maintaining his carefully crafted compromise. On December 23, 1913, Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act using four gold pens, expressing deep gratification at achieving in 12 months what had seemed impossible for decades. The Federal Reserve that emerged in 1914 pleased nobody. Too centralized for some, too decentralized for others. Too government-controlled for bankers, too banker-friendly for populists. Yet this awkward compromise has endured for over a century, evolving far beyond its creator's intentions. When America abandoned the gold standard, the Fed became the supreme arbiter of the money supply. Congress mandated dual objectives, full employment and price stability. Paul Volcker's inflation battle in the 1980s and the aggressive 2008 interventions demonstrated how far the Fed had traveled from its passive origins. The Fed emerged from genuine compromise between opposing visions, Hamiltonian centralization and Jacksonian localism, Wall Street efficiency and Main Street representation, banker expertise and democratic accountability. It wasn't perfect then and isn't now, but in a nation suspicious of concentrated power, yet needing financial stability, it was the compromise that worked. Andrew Jackson's ghost still haunts debates about the Fed's power, a permanent reminder that even the most powerful institutions must continually justify their existence to the people they serve.